Hello, this is Terry Malloy here to read The Week, the best of U.S. and international media. This is the August 9th, 2019 volume, all you need to know about everything that matters. On our cover, Seeing No Evil, why is the GOP blocking efforts to protect the 2020 election from Russian interference? Our controversy this week is Trump's Baltimore tirade with Representative Elijah Cummings. The Last Word, The Perilous Adventure of Florida Man, and Maine Stories, Should Democrats Go Left? And we begin with our cover story, the GOP's skepticism on election interference. What happened? President Trump this week tapped a skeptic of the Russian investigation to become the director of national intelligence, amid renewed warnings that the Kremlin is working to sabotage the country's vulnerable electoral infrastructure. Trump nominated Representative John Ratcliffe of Texas to oversee the nation's network of 17 spy agencies, forcing out Dan Coats. As DNI, Coats frequently undercut the president's attempts to downplay Russian meddling, defending the intelligence community's conclusion that Moscow sought to tilt the 2016 election to Trump. Ratcliffe had signed on to the Republican theory it was actually Hillary Clinton's campaign that conspired with Russia as a way to discredit Trump. He received the nomination just days after impressing Trump by attacking special counsel Robert Mueller for stating that Trump hadn't been exonerated of a crime. Quote, we need somebody strong that can really rein it in, unquote, Trump said of Ratcliffe. Because, as I think you've all learned, the intelligence agencies have run amok. They've run amok. Ratcliffe, however, faces an uphill confirmation battle, with some GOP senators skeptical about his lack of national security experience. Senator Richard Burr, head of the Intelligence Committee, called him too political. Burr's committee revealed last week that Russian hackers probed election systems in all 50 states in 2016, perhaps finding vulnerabilities to exploit in 2020. Nevertheless, Senator Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked votes on several election security bills passed by Democrats in the House of Representatives, prompting a storm of criticism with hashtag Moscow Mitch trending on Twitter. On the Senate floor, an angry McConnell called suggestions that he wanted Russia to interfere again in 2020 modern-day McCarthyism. What the editorial said. Republicans have issued an all-but-open invitation to foreign attacks on the next presidential election, said the San Francisco Chronicle. McConnell says the many election security bills he blocked were partisan legislation designed to help Democrats. But that's nonsense. One of the bills would have spent $600 million to upgrade voting machines to leave a verifiable paper trail, a security measure against hacked vote totals. McConnell also killed a bill requiring campaigns to notify authorities if foreign nationals contact them. These maneuvers suggest Trump and McConnell are not above any means of retaining power, even the assistance of the nation's enemies. McConnell isn't a toady for Russia, said the Wall Street Journal. The Senate Majority Leader has long opposed efforts to nationalize election rules that have been historically managed by the states. And he's right. A national system would be easier to hack than the systems of 50 states. The Senate, under McConnell, provides states with an additional $380 million in election security funds just last year. What the columnists said. Ratcliffe is a dangerous pick, said Garrett Graff in Wired.com. Unlike previous directors, Ratcliffe has virtually no national security experience. He has boasted that he put terrorists in prison during his brief stint as a U.S. attorney in the Bush administration, but that's a dramatic exaggeration. He was asked to review the causes of a mistrial in a single terrorism-related case. He's also a conspiracy monger, adopting the debunked rumor that the FBI had a secret society to bring down Trump. The prospect of Radcliffe standing guard against Russian interference should terrify Americans. Relax, said Eli Lake in Bloomberg.com. The DNI is a notoriously weak position. In theory, they set the budget priorities for the intelligence community. In practice, they have no power to dictate to other agencies. Without experience in the national security state, persuading subordinate agencies is near impossible. So even if Radcliffe turns out to be the lick spittle that critics fear, he'll have little impact on our counterintelligence efforts. McConnell is a far greater threat, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. Indeed, he behaves like a Russian asset. He has blocked bipartisan bills requiring internet companies to disclose who pays for political ads and to impose sanctions on anyone who attacks our elections. During the 2016 campaign, President Obama asked him to issue a joint statement on Russian interference, and McConnell refused, questioning the validity of the intelligence. A leader who won't protect our country from attack is no patriot. Moderates versus progressives on Democratic debate. What happened? Senator Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren fought off a spirited assault upon progressive policy proposals such as Medicare for All during the first round of the second Democratic presidential debates this week, as moderate rivals cast them as peddling unrealistic, far-left ideas that will only help President Donald Trump win re-election. The second round of the debate, featuring another 10 candidates, was due to take place after the week went to press. On the stage in Detroit, Montana Governor Steve Bullock bemoaned candidates offering wish list economics, while former Maryland Representative John Delaney warned that Medicare for All, which would phase out private insurance, would turn off independent voters. Former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper cautioned that if Democrats embrace the Green New Deal, a sweeping progressive plan to fight climate change, we might as well FedEx the election to Donald Trump. Sanders and Warren, who placed second and third in polls, acted almost in partnership in parrying the attacks. Sanders said grand proposals such as canceling student debt would energize young Americans who might otherwise not vote. Warren castigated her moderate rivals for lacking ambition. I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president, said the Massachusetts senator, just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for. Amid the ideological tussle, South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg sought to position himself as a compromise candidate, championing a Medicare for All Who Want It policy that would offer a public plan that competed with private insurers. What the columnists said. Centrists have spotted an opening, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Following the former Vice President Joe Biden's stumbles in the first debate, candidates such as Delaney, Bullock, and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, all of whom are polling at less than 1%, are hoping to grab a big chunk of the moderate voters the frontrunner has had to defend himself. But they'll never do that simply by slamming their left-leaning rivals' plans. They also have to offer up some ideas of their own. The debate has laid bare the divide in the party over how best to defeat Trump, said Christian Soltis Anderson in WashingtonExaminer.com. Either go with a strong liberal and disruptive agenda, or with a more pragmatic, if timid, approach. But for all their talk of being bold, Warren and Sanders repeatedly dodged tough questions over just how much their policies will cost and how much they will require average people to change their way of life. That isn't bold or brave at all. A note of interpretive caution, said John Harris in Politico.com. As much as the first round of debates in Miami left an exaggerated impression of the party's leftward drift, people should be wary of viewing Detroit as an equally abrupt lurch to the center. Even avowed centrists such as Delaney talked about hiking taxes on the rich to support liberal policies, while Klobuchar, among others, argued in favor of tighter gun controls. The inevitable conclusion? Democrats, as a party, are becoming more progressive and aggressive, even if they are zigzagging along the path a bit. The House pushes forward on impeachment question. What happened? The House Judiciary Committee told a federal court last week that it is investigating whether to recommend articles of impeachment, a major turning point in Democrats' efforts to remove President Trump. The committee is suing to access grand jury testimony redacted from Robert Mueller's report and believes that an official impeachment probe will strengthen its case in court battles to obtain Trump's tax returns, testimony from his aides, and other information the White House has refused to provide. At least 19 members of Congress came out in favor of an impeachment probe after the Mueller hearings, bringing the total to 114, nearly half of the House Democratic caucus. Polls suggest only a minority of Americans support impeachment. Though House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has opposed it, she insisted she's not trying to run out the clock and reportedly signed off on the Judiciary Committee's lawsuit. Committee Chairman Jared Nadler balked at calling the move part of an impeachment inquiry. But Representative Jamie Raskin, a Democrat from Maryland, a member of the Judiciary Committee, argued that it doesn't take a full formal House vote to begin the impeachment process. While the Constitution does not delineate what an official inquiry looks like, said Raskin, that's obviously what we're doing. What the columnists said. At no point in Trump's wretched rule has impeachment appeared more probable, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. Fence-sitting House Democrats can no longer say they're still waiting for Mueller's testimony, which successfully highlighted Trump's lawlessness and disloyalty to the country. Pelosi and Nadler devised a shrewd plan to go forward, allowing Nadler's committee to gather evidence through high-profile hearings, while Democrats from conservative districts can avoid a perilous vote. If that impeachment vote ever does occur, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com, there's a very good chance it will cost Democrats control of the House. Their caucus includes 31 Democrats from districts Trump carried in 2016, and none of them supports impeachment. Pelosi realizes a vote would be terrible for those vulnerable incumbents, sure to anger either progressives or the Trumpists they're tenuously won over. They won them by focusing on policy issues like health care, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. Yet Democrats like Nadler from very blue districts won't stop flirting with impeachment in order to pander to their base. Keep it up, and they'll give Trump a second term and a Republican Congress. Democratic dithering could be even worse, said Quinta Jurisic in the Atlantic.com. Pelosi and Nadler are terrified of the I word, but are hedging their bets. By reducing the process to political horse trading, they erase the sense of moral crisis that House Democrats worked so hard over the course of Mueller's testimony to build up. Impeachment requires moral clarity, yet Democratic leaders exude only confusion. The controversy of the week. In Baltimore, why Trump called it disgusting, and infested. Guess who just spent 3 days sending a torrent of angry racist tweets, said Timothy O'Brien in Bloomberg.com. Yes, that's right. It was the President of the United States. Reportedly upset by Representative Elijah Cummings' strong criticism of how people are being treated at border detention facilities, President Trump this week targeted the 68-year-old African-American chairman of the House Oversight Committee with a racially charged salvo of alternately bigoted, hostile, and inaccurate insults. Cummings himself is a racist, Trump tweeted, without explanation, and his majority black Maryland district, which includes Baltimore, is a disgusting black Maryland district, which includes Baltimore, which includes no human being would want to live there. Human beings obviously do live in Baltimore, said Charles Blow in the New York Times. By rendering non-white people as subhuman is a favorite trope of our blatantly racist president. Before and after he was elected, Trump was repeatedly used the degrading adjective infested to describe places where black and brown people live. As with his call for non-white U.S. congresswomen, three of them U.S.-born, to go back to their crime-infested countries of origin, Trump's rant against the disgusting cry of the city of Baltimore reveals how deeply and sincerely white supremacy is fused into his sense of the world. If acknowledging Baltimore's poverty and chaos makes one a racist, then President Trump has plenty of company, said Seth Barton in the New York Post. In a piece this March titled, quote, "The Tragedy of Baltimore," unquote, the New York Times indicted the city, which boasts the highest homicide and overall crime rates in the U.S., for a failure of order and governance, the likes of which few American cities have seen. In 2015, Senator Bernie Sanders toured Cummings' district and commented, "You would think you were in a third world country." As for the supposedly telltale word infested, Cummings himself in 1999 described his own district as drug infested. Are all these people racists? Or are they all, including Trump, simply right about Baltimore? Oh, please, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Trump's visceral association with African Americans, with crime and filth, isn't limited to Baltimore. It dates back to his real estate days when denying apartments to blacks was the basis of the Trump business model. More recently, as Michael Cohen testified before Congress, Trump, while driving through Chicago, remarked that only the blacks could live like this. For the first time, we have a U.S. president who routinely enjoys disparaging parts of his own country as disgusting hellholes. Trump is not even trying to be everyone's president, said Zachary Wolf and CNN.com. Trump's whole strategy for the 2020 is to use race to divide the country and hope angry whites turn out in sufficient numbers to reelect him. It overly flatters Trump to assume his embrace of overt racism is part of some grand political strategy, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. More likely, it's a howl of naked fear from a president who sees himself badly trailing Democrat Joe Biden in the 2020 polls. He is also unnerved by continuing efforts by House Democrats to get his tax returns and records of foreign business relationships. He has reason to be afraid. Baltimore does have its problems, including rodents, said the Baltimore Sun in an editorial. But at the risk of stooping to his level, we'd say this to the most dishonest, most immoral, and most incompetent man ever to occupy the Oval Office. Better to have a few vermin living in your neighborhood than to be one. Living in the street, on the streets, West Coast cities have booming economies, but neighborhoods that are filled with homeless people. Why? How bad is it? A tragedy paradox is on display in Los Angeles and San Francisco. Their economies are vibrant, and legions of wealthy young professionals spend small fortunes on food, cars, and other consumer goods. Yet in some neighborhoods, people live as if in third-world slums. In L.A., tent cities line freeway underpasses, armies of rats stoke fears of disease, and thousands of homeless people share a dozen toilets. In San Francisco, drug needles and garbage line the streets, and the city employs 4 full-time workers to sweep up feces. Throughout the nation, according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the homeless population has been relatively stable in recent years, with about 550,000 Americans living without homes. California accounts for 12% of the U.S. population, but a quarter of it's homeless, and it's getting worse. Los Angeles County's homeless population jumped 12% this year to nearly 59,000, while San Francisco's homeless count grew 17% over the past 2 years to about 8,000, nearly 1% of the city's population. What's driving the problem? Homelessness is a complex phenomenon with many causes, including mental illness and drug addiction. But the primary factor in California is the skyrocketing cost of housing. Over the past 6 years in L.A., the median household income grew 23%, while the median rent income increased 67%. An Angelino must earn $47.52 an hour, more than triple the minimum wage, to afford the average monthly rent of $2,471. As a result, one-third of renters qualify as severely rent-burdened, meaning they'll spend at least half of their income on housing. In those circumstances, an unexpected cost or job loss can quickly result in people failing to pay the rent and landing on the street. For every 2% increase in L.A. rent, 4,227 people are likely to become homeless, according to the real estate database Zillow. In Oakland, one of the Bay Area's most rapidly gentrifying cities, homelessness has exploded by 47% since 2017. Across the bridge in San Francisco, the median one-bedroom apartment now rents for $3,690 per month. Are there other factors? The city's temperate climates make it possible for people to live outdoors. Spending nights on the street can be nearly impossible during New York City's cold winters, which helps explain why just 5% of the city's homeless population is unsheltered. The Big Apple houses more than 61,000 people every night in about 745 shelters. 75% of LA's homeless are unsheltered, as about 70% in San Francisco. San Francisco's recently designated a city-owned parking lot for people living out of vans and RVs, allowing them to stay in this triage lot for up to 90 days. In 2007, Los Angeles officials agreed to stop enforcing an ordinance banning sleeping on the sidewalk. That allows as many as 10,000 people to live in the 50-block district known as Skid Row, a dystopian encampment where assaults and robberies run rampant. What is the impact of drug use? Drug abuse can be either a cause or a consequence of homelessness. Some people lose jobs and homes because of addiction, while others land on the streets first and become drug abusers to blot out the shame and misery of their lives. That's why dealers brazenly target homeless encampments. In Seattle, city officials say that the majority of homeless people are hooked on opioids. Among the unsheltered, 83% are believed to have a substance abuse disorder. In Los Angeles, some homeless people smoke crystal meth to stay awake at night so they can fend off thieves and assailants. San Francisco employs a crew to pick up used syringes 12 hours a day, collecting more than 140,000 in the past year. What can be done? Municipalities already are spending a lot of money on the problem. Private and public organizations in the Seattle metro area spend $1 billion each year fighting homelessness, nearly $88,000 for every homeless person. Last year, Los Angeles spent $619 million to bring 20,000 people off the streets, largely thanks to a sales tax passed in 2017. A year earlier, LA voters overwhelmingly approved raising property taxes to generate $1.2 billion for 10,000 new housing units. Willingness to spend, however, is half the battle. Building low-income housing always generates powerful, not-in-my-backyard opposition among existing homeowners who fear it will hurt their property values. But without many more affordable apartments, homelessness can't be reduced. Housing is an inescapable, unavoidable part of the solution, said University of California San Francisco professor Dr. Margot Kuschel, one of the nation's top experts on homelessness. She says it is no less true for people with substance abuse or mental health problems. It makes treatments so difficult, bordering on impossible if people are living on the streets. The era of hostile architecture. Business owners in Los Angeles are adopting aggressive tactics to keep the homeless away from camping out near their front doors. Some are putting a large array of cactus plants, thorny rose bushes, and even metal spikes on the sidewalks. Peter Mosko, operator of downtown's LA Hungarian Cultural Alliance, says dozens of homeless people began congregating outside his building, which happens to be next to a food bank. Potential clients would tell him, "I'm sorry, I really like your place, but the street is unacceptable." So without bothering to get a permit, Mosko bought 140 large planter boxes, filled them with dirt, and arranged them around his building to prevent people from sleeping on the sidewalk. In cities plagued by city street dwellers, hostile architecture is increasingly used to drive the homeless away. Well, that's it for this week. This is Terry Malloy wishing you a great week ahead. I'll be back next Sunday to read the week.